We'll get to know a scholar, anthropologist, artist, poet, and advocate for values in higher education. Anya Peterson-Royce, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you very much, Steve.
You have had a multifaceted career. Over the next hour, we'll explore some of the intersections of your life as a dancer, an ethnographer, and teacher. But I'd like to begin talking about your lifelong love of dance. You've written how, growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area, you were drawn to the ballet studio by your need for a place where things were predictable. You described the ballet studio as a rule-bound, disciplined, almost authoritarian place, and how dancers think of their lives as a sort of monastic vocation. When people on the other side of the footlights talk about the performing arts, we tend to use words like creativity and surprise and expressiveness and spirit. Is there something unique about ballet, or is the performing artist's own world something that few of us really understand?
Well, I think not many people do really understand the performer's world. When I think about that early experience in ballet, I think what I meant by that is that the craft of any art form, and particularly performing art, is essential before you can say anything. And so that discipline that I talk about in the studio that was part of my early life is part of mastering that craft. And I think Yusuf Kumanyaka, who was on our faculty for too brief a time,
poet,
wonderful poet, said once, he commented that sentimentality was passion without discipline. And I think that's quite true. If you want to be truly passionate and creative, you have to begin from a basis of discipline and having mastered a craft to the point where you don't have to think about it anymore. Mm-hmm. So the creativity and the excitement that an audience sees in a performance happens to the performer too, to the dancer as well. But it comes in the moment of performance, in that interaction between the audience and the performer that you cannot predict. You can, by mastering a craft, be fairly certain that you're going to be able to go out there and give a good performance, but you never are quite sure exactly what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's the excitement of performance.
You eventually became a professional dancer, a member first of the Brooklyn Ballet Company. What kind of work and commitment did that require?
It was a total commitment of every part of your life. When I was living in New York and dancing in Brooklyn, we had rehearsals from 9 o'clock in the morning until noon. Then I would take a very short lunch break because we couldn't eat anything, and then have class, daily ballet class, until about 4 o'clock. I would rest for a bit. If we had a performance that night, I would go to the theater for the performance, and then I went to work at midnight at the First National City Bank, because ballet companies didn't pay a living wage then. So I would work from midnight until 8 in the morning and then start all over again the next day. So it was a total commitment, and we really had not much of a life outside of dance, of the studio, of ballet, of performing.
Mm-hmm. You had prepared for a career as a professional dancer and did dance professionally, but your career on the stage was actually cut short by an accident.
Yes, it was. It was very painful at that point. I was rehearsing in San Francisco with a partner who was a very good partner, and we were trying out some lifts because we had been influenced by the Kirov visit, and they were doing spectacular lifts. And and we actually did all the spectacular ones, and then we were doing a very simple over-the-head press lift, and my balance was off and his balance was off, and I fell behind him. And I probably could have worked through the injury, but I was then 26, and at that point, the life career for a woman in ballet was about maybe 35 mm-hmm. at the most, mm-hmm. and I think my heart at that point was not in.
After this happened, you went back to school after the accident, first to Stanford and later to Berkeley for your PhD. How difficult was it, being a little older at that point than the typical undergraduate student, picking up school and setting off on a new path?
I think it's always difficult to change directions, especially when you've chosen your life's work at the age of 7, and then at 26 it becomes not possible anymore. So it was difficult. It was difficult to be back in school, having been dancing and working professionally, using my body rather than my mind. I went back to school. I had been in Slavic languages and literature initially, and I went back in comparative literature in French and Italian because languages came easily to me. And I thought, well, I can. This is something that I'm interested in and that I can do. I took an anthropology course as part of Stanford's massive distributional requirement and fell in love with it.
And that was the field where, indeed, you got your PhD then at Berkeley.
Yes.
And so you were led to the discipline of anthropology by one of those required classes, one of those core curriculum classes that students often complain about having to teach. Yet so often we hear these sort of serendipitous stories about how it changed someone's life. In your case, led you to your next career.
Well, I'm an advocate of letting students explore and giving them some guidance as they do that.
Mm-hmm. In one of your books about ballet and mime, one of your scholarly fields has become, not surprisingly, the anthropology of dance. You write about how throughout human history, going as far back as Plato, movement has been controversial, that various times and various cultures have thought of the movement of the human body as being associated with either good or with bad. Talk about that. What's the historical overview of movement and how it's been viewed through cultural mm-hmm. contexts?
If you think about it, the first thing that one human being sees about another human being is the way they stand and the way they move. So that even before people say anything, so that you can classify who they might be on the basis of how they speak, you've already made some decisions about them on the basis of their posture and about the way they move. And it's not something that we normally think about, analyze in our everyday life, but we have made those decisions already in our mind. And it's very hard then to overcome that. So that, for example, when the British were colonizing Africa, they were outraged by what they saw in terms of dances and movements on the part of the African groups in the countries where they went. What we don't know so much about or has not been so much written about is that the Africans were equally outraged by the British because they thought that a man and a woman dancing together, holding each other, was outrageous because that never happened in African societies. So we make all kinds of assumptions about who a person is based on how they move. And I think it has to do with the fact that movement generates a kind of kinesthetic response. It's you probably know when you go to a dance performance, it's very hard to sit there without moving, or it's hard for me to sit there without moving, particularly if it's Alvin Ailey or a company like that, because your body picks up on the kinesthetic energy that's being generated in the dance. And it happens to a lesser extent even in ordinary movement when people are moving. So I think that even if the movement is something that you find agreeable, you may not like the fact that your body is responding without mm-hmm. your mind having something to say about it.
Does this all have to do in some way with a latent or underlying attitudes about or fears about sensuality, physicality? How much of this has to do with sexuality, sensuality, concepts of the body, or is that just a part of it?
I think it's part of it. Jonas Barish has written a great book called The Anti-Theatrical Prejudice, where he explores that issue. But I think it's more fundamental than that. I think it has to do with the fear of difference. We're just not normally comfortable when we're confronted with something that is outside our knowledge, outside our area, our comfort zone in terms of what we know.
We're going to take a break for a minute and listen to the first of several pieces of music you've chosen to accompany this interview. And I'd like to ask you in each case to talk a little bit about each one. The first one is the Sonata No. 2 for cello and piano by Felix Mendelssohn. We'll be listening to the Adagio movement, the third movement. What is it about this piece that's significant to you? Why did you choose this piece?
First of all, I think it's the performers. Above anything else, they played together for many, many years. And listening to any of their recordings, particularly this one, I think, in the Brahms sonatas, is like listening to a conversation between old friends. And I love both performances in this particular adagio movement. It begins with the piano, and then the cello comes and responds and goes back and forth. So that's probably why I chose that one.
Okay. Let's listen. The adagio movement of Mendelssohn's Sonata No. 2 for cello and piano. Was the third movement, the adagio movement of Felix Mendelssohn's Sonata No. 2 in D major, Opus 58, Sonata for cello and piano, two performers long associated with Indiana University, Janos Starker and Yori Shebak. We're speaking with Anya Royce. One of the other major themes of your research over the years, we talked about the anthropology of dance and movement. One of the other major themes, indeed starting in your junior year of college, has been the lives of one of the indigenous peoples of Mexico, the Isthmus Zapotec. First, who are the Isthmus Zapotec?
The Isthmus Zapotec are the third, well, the Zapotec as a whole, are the third most numerous indigenous group in Mexico today. There are about 250,000 Zapotec altogether. They go back to well before the Spanish conquest, and for some 2,500 years, various groups and peoples have tried to exterminate, accommodate, assimilate, and otherwise deal with the Zapotec, and they've managed to survive and thrive, all of those external powers.
How many people are we talking about? What region of Mexico?
The Isthmus Zapotec are in the southern part of the state of Oaxaca and mostly in the city of Juchitán, which is a city now of about 100,000 people. When I first started working there in 1967, it was some 26,000. So it's grown quite a bit.
The paradigm for your work with the Zapotec is your interest in ethnicity and identity, how people define themselves. How does that play out in your work and in your looking at this population?
I think the question that first drew me to the Zapotec, actually what drew me to the Zapotec initially, was seeing a performance, a dance performance by the Zapotec from the city of Juchitán in 1967 it's called a Galagueza, and it's a wonderful coming together of all the groups in Oaxaca City, and they all perform. The next to the last group on that occasion was this delegation of Zapotec from Juchitán. And I'd been sitting in the sun for about 5 hours by then, and I was really tired and wanted to go home. And they came on stage and just blew me away. They were extraordinary. The women were beautiful and tall, and the costumes were extraordinary. And the dance was like nothing I'd ever seen in terms of Mexican dance. So I had no choice after that, after seeing them. The next year, I went back for the summer. And then I began reading about them and discovering what an extraordinary people they were, how they had been able to maintain a sense of being Zapotec in a country which did not value its indigenous people. So that then became a real focus for me, looking at the ways in which they were able to do that. And my first book, which came out in Mexico in Spanish, because I think it's important that the people who invite you into their lives are able to read what you write about them, really dealt with the economic, political, and historical reasons behind their ability to maintain themselves as Zapotec. The book I'm working on now has to do more with the structural and symbolic aspects of why they chose that. The first book was sort of how they managed to do it. This book is why do that instead of making some other kind of choice.
You've done field work among the Zapotec for now some 30, 35 years. I'm wondering what is it like to have your life intertwined, as you've described it, for so long with another culture? You've described going to church services, developing almost familial relationships with people. What's that like in a context where you get to know people and families almost intimately, yet also need to retain a certain scholarly detachment as an anthropologist?
It's been an extraordinary gift for me. The Zapotec are a warm, generous, loving people. I think like all anthropologists, we rely on the kindness of strangers. I mean, we begin trying to understand another culture in the middle, in media res, because we step in and they have lives and we're stepping in the middle of them trying to understand. So that our ability to understand depends very much on the people whose lives we're looking at. And the Zapotec have given me an extraordinary gift. You mentioned familial. They are my family, very much my family, with the same kinds of obligations that you have with a biological family and the same kinds of ties and rewards. Now, the question is, how do you do this and maintain a professional stance as an anthropologist? I think that when people talk about objectivity, it's a myth to begin with. Because if you're dealing with human beings and you're a human being, there's no question about your ability to take away your humanity in this. You react as a human being to other human beings. So the myth, it's a myth mm-hmm. that you can be objective. What you can do is to pay attention, to spend a long period of time. You don't have to spend 35 years, but invest a long period of time. Listen to what people say. Collect evidence like you would for any kind of activity.
You approach this work through interviews, I assume, through the study of data, through observation. How often do you get to Mexico? How often do you get to this region? How often do you go back? How many people have you gotten to know and interview over these 35 years?
I now go back at least twice a year. I've gone, in the past, gone back fewer times than that, but now it's two times a year or three times a year, depending on when I can manage to get down there. And a lot of that has to do with family obligations. And I think to go back to your question about how are you an anthropologist and a member of a family, part of how they see building community and maintaining themselves as a group is that everybody has an obligation to the common good, to the community, but that each individual has a different way of meeting that obligation. So my way of meeting my obligation to the Zapotec community is to tell their story. It's to be the anthropologist, so that they allow me, indeed, expect me to be able to stand back and talk about them.
Is your role in some way what in African cultures might be called a griot, a storyteller, someone with responsibility for passing down the history and the story of a people?
I think in one sense it's very much
that. Seeing
that
it's preserved.
It's very much that. If you spend any length of time with another people as an anthropologist, you feel that responsibility and that obligation to tell their story, because likely you're the only person who's going to have committed that much time to them. And if you don't tell it, it doesn't get told. So there's very much a responsibility there. And that's why telling it in at least in Spanish is very important for me.
You've talked about how the population has grown considerably mm-hmm. in the years that you've studied them. Is this – often we think of the kind of work you're doing as documenting and studying and telling the story of a people who have lived a precarious existence and who may be in danger of actually disappearing and whose culture may mm-hmm. disappear and become extinct one day. Is that the case with the Zapotec, or is that not the direction in which this particular culture is moving? Is that one of the reasons for your work, to preserve it for the long term, to preserve the culture?
Let me sort out the three questions that you asked. First of all, I think there's also another myth about anthropologists that we deal with populations that are marginal in some senses, and that's not ever really been the case. Sometimes we do. The Zapotec, after 35 years now of being part of their lives, are probably more vibrant and strong in their Zapotec identity than they were when I began. They have two radio stations that broadcast in Zapotec. They have four journals that publish in Zapotec. They have a whole new generation of young artists, painters, who are sort of talking about Zapotec culture in that visual way. So I think their sense of who they are as Zapotec is very strong. At the same time, they function quite well in the Mexican environment. They travel all around the world. They go to Paris and London and Greece, and so they're kind of an extraordinary group of people. But it is very important to have someone who has spent the kind of time I have and who has cared about them as I have tell that story, because they're also a people who have attracted the attention of outsiders who may not have that commitment to the long term, filmmakers who are interested in the third gender population, people who are interested in what they see as a dominant role of women in the culture. And of course, if you go down there and you spend a week, you can come away with all kinds of mistaken ideas. And they're at the mercy, in the sense of film crews and journalists who go down there to record this marvelous, exciting, unusual culture.
Briefly, what's the third gender population?
It's very similar to what you find in North America, among native populations in North America, Berdash. Mm-hmm. These are males who take on sometimes occupational roles that are embroidering the local costumes, creating floats for the parades. Now more and more of them are working in white-collar jobs, but who have adopted the role of a Zapotec woman, mm-hmm, rather than a man. Okay. So, and there's a Zapotec word for them, and they're fairly well established in that culture.
What's the word?
Mujer.
Okay. We're going to take another break and listen to another piece of music that you've chosen. Tell us about the Mozart, the Ave Verum Corpus, that we'll be listening to, a choral piece.
It's a piece of music which is just extraordinarily connects itself to your soul immediately. It's a beautiful, clear, pristine kind of sense of music. And the interesting thing is that Mozart wrote it for a friend of his, Anton Stoll, who was a choir master in Baden, and wrote to Mozart and said, "Can you write me a piece for my choir?" And this is what came out of it, and it's an extraordinary piece of music.
Okay, let's listen then. This is Robert Shaw conducting the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra and Chorus. This is the motet Ave Verum Corpus by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, Robert Shaw conducting the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra and Chorus, a piece chosen by our guest today on Profiles, Anya Peterson-Royce. I'm Steve Sanders for WFIU. After earning your PhD, you joined the faculty of Indiana University, and you later served for almost 10 years as one of the senior administrators on the Bloomington campus, the dean of faculties, later called the vice chancellor for academic affairs, with responsibility for things like tenure and promotion, the professional development of faculty and department chairs, other important functions that operate campus-wide. What were your major goals in this position? How did you hope to leave the campus a different place, a better place, after taking a turn in its administration?
Well, with hindsight, because I don't know that I had these goals when I took the position, one of the first things that we did in that office was to do a series of studies, interviews with faculty. And probably that's my anthropological background. And if you want to know what programs might be helpful, why don't you go ask the people that you're creating the programs for? And so we did. Mary Dean Sorcinelli was a wonderful staff person in my office then, and we interviewed some 240 faculty across two schools and four disciplines, and basically asked them, you know, what they did, what they thought about the university, what kinds of programs would they like? How could we help them do what they did best, mm-hmm. better?
And then how did this change the shape of what that office did?
We created 27 programs. Basically had to do with helping faculty create careers that were satisfying to themselves and that were of benefit to the institution. I spent a lot of my time trying to get around the policies so that people, in fact, could do what they really do best. So I think that one of the things that came out of those 10 years for me was a sense of satisfaction at having responded to some very real needs on the part of the faculty, to look at faculty careers not in this kind of linear, boxed-in way that we tend to look at them, where every faculty member is interchangeable with every other faculty. Each faculty is crucial and unique in the way they make their career. And so I think that those programs help them keep that sense. Some of the interdisciplinary programs, of course, brought faculty together, and we created extraordinary things out of that coming together, mm-hmm. with not a whole lot of money. Mm-hmm. It was a time, too, when people would collaborate and cooperate, and Mort Lohengreb was dean of research and graduate development at one point, and then George Walker took his place in that office, and our office cooperated in creating programs that neither one of us could have done mm-hmm. on our own.
Mm-hmm. During your time in the Dean of Faculty's office, we're talking the early 1980s to the early 1990s, I think 1983 to 1992, this was a time of some ferment in higher education, questions about how faculty spend their time, what their roles are, how they're rewarded. During this time, one of the things that IU created, you had a central role in this, was something called FACET, the Faculty Colloquium on Excellence in Teaching. FACET came about in part because of a perception that in a university like IU, research was rewarded in a disproportionate way, much more so than teaching. At least that's the perception. Indeed, some faculty believed that investing themselves in teaching could actually hurt their careers. What was the impetus for FACET? How did you want to see a group like FACET address that concern?
It came out of several meetings that Eileen Bender, Fran Snigg, and I had about what we might do to help faculty who were extraordinary teachers, but who were isolated in that commitment to teaching. Faculty who were great researchers often had groups, other faculty they could talk with about that. People who had invested in teaching often didn't have anybody else they could talk to about what they were trying to do and accomplish. And so we really wanted to give them a place where they could talk about it, and at the same time to recognize their contribution to the university. And so I don't exactly remember what conversation it was when we generated the name FACET, but we were sort of playing with the idea of something that was brilliant and bright because we thought these faculty were, and I came up with that, and it's stayed.
And I read that actually during these after-hours conversations when this idea was evolving, you weren't altogether sure that this was something that would be fully embraced by the upper administration of the university. Yet you felt that if it came to that, if for some reason this didn't fly, if there was some opposition or some suspicion to the idea of this group, you could always invoke the legacy of Herman Wells, which was that, you know, you should always be able to try new things in a university.
We were prepared to invoke almost anything in order to make this this work because we really believed in it. And there were some outside funding agencies too. But I think that one of the things that, sold it to Tom Ehrlich, who was then president, was the fact that it was all campuses. It was not just a Bloomington program. And I think it may have been one of the very first all-campus programs that acknowledged faculty. So he was fairly supportive. And I think it was very hard to say no to Eileen and to me and I, because we were prepared to go ahead with this.
I want to talk a little bit about now how your work with FACET, your thinking and speaking and coaching about teaching has intersected with other parts of your career. When you spoke to members of FACET this past academic year, you talked about how – you talked about some of the similarities among performing and ethnography and teaching. You said that in all these fields, the very best practitioners have the ability to become transparent to their audiences, really, I guess, to give up one's ego in psychoanalytic terms. You spend much of your life perfecting yourself as an instrument, you said, and in the moment that counts, you must disappear. Elaborate on that.
I think it's, of course, we always get better at figuring out what we did as we get older and we have more material to deal with. And I think that, hindsight, and actually writing the book that I'm finishing now, has brought together all of those issues for me. That really what has concerned me and ties together those areas is the role of the interpreter, somebody who stands in the middle between one body and another body. In the case of performing artists, it's the created work and the audience. In the case of teaching, it's standing between the body of knowledge that you are trying to convey and the students. And I think looking at artists initially, the very best performers for me are the ones who let you see the work and come to it on your own without their always calling attention to themselves. So that for me, Baryshnikov would be a dancer who does that. Baryshnikov is an artist, a virtuoso. He can do anything in terms of dance. And what he does on stage is to present Balanchine or Petipa or Fokine or whoever he's doing, so that you can see that pure, kind of straight, without him interfering, although it's his body that does that.
He's mediating, yet
yes.
You're not aware of that.
You're not aware of it. Mm-hmm. It's the difference between Sir John Gielgud and John Wayne. Sir John Gielgud, you know, plays Lear and it's Lear. John Wayne is always John Wayne.
It's always John Wayne, right.
So that's a kind of a mundane example, but it gets the point. So, and I think it calls on that person, that interpreter, to in fact give up the satisfaction of presenting yourself as the person who's accomplished all of this. And I think it's very hard for faculty to do that because you really want to claim that kind of authority, but that's the worst way, in fact, to convey the excitement or the importance of the material.
Mm-hmm. In this talk that you gave to FACET, you also said something that surprised me, and I take it that this is something that needs some elaboration. You said that at some point you realized in looking around at the colleagues you've known that the finest teachers you knew were people who did not bring their personalities into the classroom. When just read that way, it sounds almost counterintuitive that the best teachers are the most entertaining, the ones with the largest personalities. How did you mean that?
I think if you really believe in your discipline and what you're teaching about, that's the entertainment. That's what students can connect with is really the material. And for anthropology, it's fairly easy because I think it's such exciting material. It doesn't mean that you don't have a personality, and it doesn't mean that students don't know who you are, because I think it's very important for students to have a sense that you're a real human being, that you have opinions. But I also think it's important that you not make those the center of the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
The center of the classroom has to be the learning that takes place among all of you with the material. If you watch, for example, Janosch Starker teaching in a master class or a lesson, it's very tempting if you're a great artist just to do something and tell the student, okay, do that. Do it like that. But that's not very good pedagogy, and it doesn't help the student at all understand it. And Starker almost never does that.
That answer is actually a wonderful segue, because the next piece of music, the third piece of music we're going to listen to that you chose, is a movement, the second movement from the Cello Concerto in A minor, Opus 129 by Robert Schumann. This is performed by Indiana University faculty member Janusz Starker. Why did you choose this piece? What's significant about this piece to you?
I do have musical preferences in terms of composers, but what usually leads me to pick a particular performance is the performer. And in this case, it's the way in which Starker approaches this concerto, and in particular this slow movement. It's harder to play slow than it is to play fast, and this is just an extraordinary performance of that particular concerto.
Okay. Let's listen then. The second movement of the Cello Concerto in A minor by Robert Schumann, performed by Janusz Starker. We've listened to the second movement from the Cello Concerto in A minor, Opus 129 by Robert Schumann, performed by Janusz Starker, chosen by our guest on Profiles, Anya Peterson-Royce. Several years ago, Indiana University sponsored a conference on what was called academic civility. This was prompted by some rising concerns at that time about the way faculty and students treat each other in the classroom. In an address that you gave at that conference, you said that whether civility and a sense of community prevail on a campus like IU begins with the values of the institution and how the administration, and you had spent time in administration, been close to many administrators, and I gather this helped to influence your thinking about this, how the administration gives signals about what's valued in an academic community. What did you mean by that?
I think the key word there is community. A university is a community. It's an academic community, which is a particular subset of communities. But people who make a commitment to a community need to feel that what they contribute to it is valued. And people are not all the same. Faculty are not all the same. Not even the same faculty will be the same over his or her career. For example, there might be a point where you are really into your research and writing, and then another point when you've got all this and you want to share it, and so you spend a lot of time teaching. Or your work has become important to the community at large, and so you spend more of your time in service activities. And I think we know that about faculty. We pretend sometimes that we don't, but we do know that. And so the university needs to be able to respect and value all of those ways of contributing to the university in the same way that we need to look at our students. They're all different. They're not, you know, you have a class of 89 students and there are 89 individuals out there with different kinds of motivations. And as a faculty member, you need to understand that and respect who each of them is coming into that class. The administration has an obligation to acknowledge and respect as well, and to make it possible for people to do their jobs, to facilitate them in doing their jobs so that they don't have to deal with bureaucracy, students ought not to have to go to 17 different places to get registered, and faculty ought not to have to go through the same bureaucratic hoops.
Mm-hmm. You talked also about how some of the incivility in classroom contexts, especially some student behaviors, can arise out of a fear of diversity, and that we sometimes don't see diversity as enriching us. This gets back, I know, to your scholarly interest in ethnic diversity.
Well, first of all, you have to understand what a classroom is like. I mean, you bring in 25 or 70 students, and they're sitting in your classroom, and they're all there for different reasons. And they don't know each other for the most part. I mean, you may have a group of three who know each other, but mostly they don't know each other. And it's very threatening to people to reveal who they are to an anonymous group of people. And so that's why students don't talk or say anything about themselves. And so the faculty member really has to create a climate where students can trust each other, mm-hmm. can feel that they can say something and be heard. So listening is probably the key to that. And I think one of the things that came out of 9/11, for example, was a kind of, in my class, this undergraduate sophomore level class of 80 students, was the trust that the students had for each other. Normally, I try to work on that, and by about the fourth week into the semester, they're doing pretty well with it. This was kind of overnight, mm-hmm. because they had all experienced something. We all shared.
Just a week or two into the semester.
Right. So as tragic and horrific as it was, it did something to that class. It made them care for each other. And I think that's the climate that one has to create.
Okay. During your adult life, evidently believing that with teaching and writing and administering and doing field work, life wasn't busy enough, you took up the cello and studied with Helga Winold here at Indiana University at the IU School of Music. Why the cello? How has studying and performing an instrument added to your life?
I chose it because I'd always loved the cello. And if I hadn't been spending all my time in a ballet studio, I might have studied the cello when I was young. So I love the instrument. I love the voice of that instrument. I did it. There were two other reasons, I think, for studying it. One is that I knew I wanted to be able to write about performance and interpretation in a broader way than looking at dance. And I thought I needed to know something from actually having tried it, so that I could speak from that perspective. And so I signed up for cello lessons with Helga Winold, who's an extraordinary teacher. She's one of the best teachers I've ever had, and very patient with someone like me. The other reason, I think, was that I had gotten fairly confident about writing, and I realized that what I really needed to do was to take on something where the standards were very clear, where there was no negotiation. When you write, if you write well, you can convince people of almost anything. But when you're playing the cello, you better have the notes right, mm-hmm. because, I mean, there are standards. And I wanted to have that kind of discipline that I had when I was dancing. Mm-hmm. So that was another reason to do that.
How often do you practice?
Oh, you shouldn't ask me that question now. I practiced fairly assiduously when I was taking lessons because I was terrified every week to go in for my lesson and not be prepared.
Finally, you're also a poet. You write poetry. You're active with a group in readings and publishing some poetry and recording some poetry called Five Women Poets. How long have you done that? How long have you written poetry?
I guess I've written poetry seriously for maybe 30 years. I wrote before that, but I think most people write poetry and then some of us get serious about it.
Mm-hmm. So, what do you write about?
Mark Doty, who was here actually in the writer's workshop this summer and is a wonderful poet, has said that he believes that all poems are already written and they're out there, and that they find a voice and they come through different people. And I think that's partly true because it's in the same way that it's the same sense in which you have to be disciplined for something to work. You can't have inspiration without a discipline behind it, and I think poetry is the same way. You have to really write and practice it, and then the poems come. I try to hear different voices. I try to say things that matter to me in a voice that will reach other kinds of audiences. Sometimes I write about things that I encounter as an anthropologist. So I've written poetry about the Zapotec, about the Apache. I'm interested in the phenomenon of shamans and shapeshifters and trying to analyze that and put it into a poetic form. And I've written about dance. Mm-hmm.
Is writing poetry more like the experience of the cello, as you described it, or more like dancing and writing and other things that are more expressive and that are more open to interpretation?
Poetry for me is they come, and I'm there, and I write them down, and then the craft comes in really looking at them. And the Five Women Poets group is wonderful because we critique each other's work, mm-hmm. and you begin to get a sense of what works and what doesn't work. But the ideas come, and it's like the responsibility that I feel for the Zapotec. I have a responsibility to those words that are there and that come through me. So I don't know if it's more like, it's a different kind of writing for mm-hmm. me. I like to write. I write dance reviews for the HT. I write for the Writer. I like to be able to write in different ways that reach different audiences, because I think that the important thing for us in the university is to be able to, or as human beings, is to be able to communicate with other people mm-hmm. and not only to a very small subset. Mm-hmm. So for sometimes a thought will reach people better in poetic form than okay. in an essay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, I think the idea in what you said about communication and communication taking different forms is a good way to sort of summarize much of what you've done and much of the work that you've done as an ethnographer and as a performer and as an exponent for teaching and values and administration. So, Anya Peterson-Royce, thanks very much for joining us on Profiles.
Thank you very much, Steve.
For Profiles and for our guest, IU faculty member, Chancellor's Professor of Anthropology, Anya Peterson-Royce, I'm Steve Sanders.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in July of 2002. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash, Luann Johnson, research assistant. Copies of this and other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.